Hi, and welcome to the VFX Show. I'm Mike Seymour, and I'm joined again by John Flowers. John, how are you?
Fantastic. How are you?
Good. How's things in, where are you at the moment? San Francisco?
Yeah, I'm in San Francisco. It's been a great week. Very warm this week.
Yes. Not so warm, though, in other parts of America. There was a huge temperature differential between our Chicago office and Sydney. I actually worked it out. It's like 136 degrees Fahrenheit difference between my 38, 40 degrees heat centigrade and their minus 20 centigrade in Chicago. But apparently San Francisco is exempt from this. You're getting some pretty nice weather there, I guess.
Yeah, it's been in the 60s, 70s, and 80s for the last week, which, you know, it's in the dead of our winter, so that's pretty shocking. This time last year, it was 30s to 40s.
Wow.
Once again, all in Fahrenheit.
Well, we're joined by a longtime contributor, first-time host. Laurie, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
So, welcome. How are you?
I am well, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Give everybody a hint of your background and your involvement with the VFX show.
I got involved because I'm part of the Pixel Corps and joined one of the podcasting groups and have been doing research for various projects over the last year and year and a half. I also did my own podcast called For Art's Sake. It's a high-definition video podcast, and it has 12 episodes up on iTunes and on networks. They're short interviews with artists talking about their art, and it's available in high definition or iPod size.
Yeah, I must admit, I was really stunned at the quality of the camera work on that when I saw it. I was really impressed. I thought it was terrific, and I guess what I was surprised about was that you didn't actually have a big professional crew on that, did you?
No, it was just a crew of two, myself and my husband, and we didn't know much about lighting for video or shooting video, or even the audio end of it was a challenge, but we learned quickly, and he gave me lots of advice on setting up the shots, and he would conduct the interviews while I manned the camera and the audio.
And in fact, your husband is a graphic novel artist, isn't he? Somebody that John picked up on. Is that correct, Laurie?
Yes, yes. His name is Brian Apthorpe.
Which,
and he's a penciler.
Which impressed you no end, John?
Yeah, he did Son of Batman.
Cool. How extremely cool. Well, look, this week we're going to be doing the show Pushing Daisies. And let me explain how this works. We've done these before. We did it with Battlestar Galactica. These are hugely popular. Think of it like a DVD extra without the DVD. What you can do is download the show from iTunes, and in a few minutes we'll start watching it, and we'll let you know when we do that. And the episode we're watching is the first one from Series 2, and it's called Bzzz. And the idea is that we'll all start playing it simultaneously, and we will narrate the show and discuss the visual effects as it goes through. The show goes for about 43 minutes, and basically, if you'd like to, you can watch the show and listen along. Of course, it doesn't stop you from just listening along while walking the dog, but as I said, these have been popular in the past. Now, John, am I right in thinking that that Pushing Daisies actually got terminated at the end of this season? Is that right?
Yeah, that's the story, that it's been cancelled.
Which I guess begs the question, do you think we're in a period at the moment of experimentation and of interest in terms of new television shows in the US, or are we in one of those bleak periods where it's all very formularistic and sort of made to cookie-cutter standards?
Well, I think that I'm going to have a lot of people throw tomatoes at me when I say this, but I think we're in a really bleak period, at least when it comes to most of the standard television stations like ABC, NBC, CBS, and even Fox to some extent. I think a lot of these stations are just kind of, as David Strapinis is fond of saying, they're dancing on the corpse of something that they've already done, you know, and kind of milking it for whatever they can. But other stations, ironically, if you have premium cable, stations like Showtime, HBO, and even AMC, are producing content like John Adams, like Californication, True Blood, and even Mad Men, which if you haven't seen Mad Men, I would encourage everyone to see that show.
Oh, yeah. I love that show. So, Laurie, you're the one that recommended Pushing Daisies. Why did you recommend this show for us?
It's a show I became aware of during the first season. I heard all about good reviews and critical acclaim, and I checked it out on the internet at the ABC website, and was very impressed with the visual style and the writing and the acting, and just it was so unique. it really caught me, and I started watching all the back episodes on the internet. And that tends to be the way I view it on the internet. I like the widescreen proportions, and I don't have a TV that does that right now. So it's the best viewing thing for me right now is to view it HD streaming from the ABC website. But I see that they've taken down those episodes right now. So it looks like the best way to get it is on iTunes right now.
Yeah, I must admit, I have an HD set at home, and this is available in HD or standard def from the iTunes store. So what we're going to do now, hopefully you guys have had a chance to click on the download button and get the episode Bzzz. So I'm going to count down from five, and then all of the three of us hosts will actually start watching the show. And if you're following along at home or on your laptop, hit play as well, and then we'll actually track and run through without stopping on the show. So if everyone is ready, five... 4, 3, 2, 1. So, John, this is an interesting show because it does actually have a brief title sequence, and title sequences aren't that popular anymore, are they? They seem to have sort of gone the way of the dodo.
Yeah, you don't see them. One of the things, again, I like about Mad Men is it has a fantastic title sequence as well.
Yeah, I really like that. Though, I wonder, did that predate the James Bond Casino Royale? I don't think it did because that was sort of very similar to the James Bond Casino Royale titles, albeit without the card motif. But I agree, right. The Mad Men thing is just superb. So, Laurie, give us a brief outline why Mum is dying here and what's going on. What is the sort of central premise of this show?
Well, this young boy has discovered that he has the power to bring the dead back to life. And he sees his mom fall over in the kitchen there and touches her and sees that she's fine again. He doesn't realize at this point that if he doesn't let something that die in its own time die, then something else will die in its place. Here, she kisses him, and the second touch is permanent death. And he finds that out that after his next-door neighbor's father died because he let his mom live, now he's also lost his mom, too. He's got a lot of guilt right now.
So basically, it's a bit like a Midas touch thing, that he can save someone's life, but when he saves their life, he can never touch them again. And there's a big visual effect shot, that house shot. At least I think that was a visual effect shot, or it was a child's toy thing. But all of these shots are so stylized that I guess we need to discuss whether or not you buy into that or not, because a lot of these are incredibly stylized shots. Not only stylized in terms of visual effects, but just stylized the art direction. I mean, these are V-suits are incredibly non-realistic in nature. John, do you like this style of kind of overly chromed, very saturated, stylized cinematography and production design?
Yeah, I mean, when I first saw the show, which I have to say was pretty recent when we started talking about maybe doing this episode, you know, I took a look at it and I was completely blown away by when you look at this, you say to yourself, this is a fairy tale, and you either go along for the ride or you don't. Now, me personally, visually, I'm along for the ride. I think it's fantastic. Love the colors, love all of the wacky ways in which things are designed. There's the pie hole, which is a really big centerpiece of the entire show. Although my understanding is that the pie hole is actually kind of a practical set as well as some digital add-ons as well.
Laurie, do you know how much of this show is done with virtual set technology?
I think there is quite a bit done, but the usual settings for the pie hole are practical. Even the exterior is a practical, transparent painting, really. It's lit from behind, and they can actually shoot with the actors right up against it. So they try to do a mixture of special effects with visual effects, and I think it blends very nicely and gives them a lot of interesting different ways to achieve this fairy tale look. It's great.
I mean, of the shots we've seen so far, the shot of the ocean liner, for example, I mean, that presents a classic problem. It's not a major plot point that you want to spend a lot of money on because it's just an establishing shot for the attack that happens on the boat. And yet the shot itself, by normal visual effects standards, was pretty friggin' hokey. Do we, or do you forgive it that, Laurie, because it's so stylized, or do you sort of bug you to see, you know, fairly, the truck burning didn't look particularly real, for example.
I kind of like it because it almost feels like it's a pop-up book. You kind of buy into this fairy book perfect world with the bright colors and the almost timeless clothing that the people are wearing. It's just this beautiful skies that are behind him there. I mean, it's I think I could buy into it pretty easily. I don't get distracted by it at all. I think it's all set by the tone.
I hate
the tone
it.
Of the humor.
I really hate it. I just really? The keys aren't. It's never going to sell because it's stylized as a storybook. But it's not a storybook. It's a narrative drama, if you could call that narrative comedy.
Right.
And it just see the thing is, I could take it if this was a flashback sequence, but as an entire series, I just tire. Like that shot there, right? We're holding depth of field from his shoulder. Almost right through to the skyline behind, and the clouds would be slightly out of focus. There's a whole lot of things that just are screaming it to me. This is not quite right. The level of saturation, the level of exposure that you're getting inside her mask and the sky behind, like it's all too picturesque. And now I could just be, you know, out of control here. I mean, there are things like this that I have bought. Like I bought, for example, Moulin Rouge, which was terribly stylized. But this is. This is Disney movie of the week for me. I mean, I guess how far do you have to stylize it before you just forgive it its faults, and does its faults affect anything? And yet, of course, you guys both really like it. So this shot here, right? This is a very obvious camera move of a digital set. I don't mind the art direction of things being perky. I mean, I love the art direction in Mad Men, but do not the keys or anything bother you, John?
No, not at all. I'll tell you, the irony of this whole situation is, yeah, the keys are horrible. Yeah, everything is focused wrong. Yeah, the colors are completely oversaturated. But what we're looking at here is the equivalent of a Natalie Merchant song. Natalie Merchant is the lead singer of 10,000 Maniacs, and she sings these songs that are beautiful and melodic, but the words themselves are so dark and disturbing and haunting that you feel this sense of kind of tug of war with your senses. You know, is it good? Is it bad? And this show has the same thing for me. Frankly, the one thing I don't forgive the show for has nothing to do with the stylization or the digital sets or the keying or any of that. It is the god-awful dialogue perpetrated by primarily this character, which is Chi McBride. His real name. He plays Emerson Codd. And then the two women who have not yet been introduced, and then the sort of side, like trying to be way too hip for itself commentary that everyone seems to have, up to and including Jim Dale, who is the narrator, who for Christ's sake did the audiobooks for Harry Potter prior to this. So he's got a great voice.
I guess for me, and Laurie, feel free to disagree, but like this sequence through here, this which is coming up with the, you know, sort of background of her getting the job and all this kind of stuff. It's easy for me to disconnect. I don't actually, like it's a very constant beat. This to me is a Spice Girls song. This isn't John Lee Hooker. This is like, it's pretty, but it's got no depth. You want to comment?
Well, I think I enjoy the banter that they have, the fast dialogue. It kind of reminds me of the old Hollywood double entendre movies with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall, and it's just refreshing. I think
we're more pillow talk with Doris Day here, aren't we?
Well, I don't know. You haven't seen maybe all the episodes, but it's a very sweet but very sexy show at the same time. And
what do we think of this visual effects makeup, or sorry, special effects makeup on our dead actress?
I think it's very interesting that whenever they bring somebody back to life, it's almost a cartoonish type of cause of death that's being shown on them, and they usually seem to be pretty easygoing about being awakened and told that they're dead. I think it's important to the tone of the humor of the show and what's going on that they walk a fine line here between the dark humor and the mystery of the show and the fairy tale feeling of the show. It's a delicate balance.
But you buy the special effects makeup? I mean, doesn't it just bother you? Like that green, that just looks like plastic stuck. I mean plastic stuck on top of her skin with a bodysuit and not particularly good blending of the makeup.
Well, I think if it looked too real, it would be too gross to be funny. I mean, it's supposed to be funny, so you can't have it look like somebody is really suffering there or it's too gross to enjoy. I don't really like a lot of horror, gory things anyway, and I don't think it belongs in a show like this. So I think they need to do something that's a little cartoony here as far as the effects makeup.
Okay. I'm not seeing it technically, and secondly, I have, as I say, trouble empathizing with the characters because I never feel like I'm getting. I feel like I'm at a cocktail party, and people are just, doing that banter that you do when you kind of ask about things, but don't actually want to hear what they have to say. It seems sort of superficial, and these camera moves are all so heavy-handed, and the move-in and the framing and the dutching and the like. These move-ins we're just seeing right now. It's meant to be
a comic book, right? It's meant to be a comic book.
Yeah.
So all the camera angles are really bizarre, up to and including there. If you look, there are dozens of camera shots where the camera is either too close, too far, above them, below them. I mean, it's like looking at panes in a comic book.
So let's talk about visual effects in terms of serving the story. This show must rely on a reasonable amount of art department extension as well as just full-on matte paintings. Is this show indicative, Laurie, of the whole series, or is this an odd episode for us to be reviewing?
No, I think this is a pretty representative one. They have a lot of special effects shots, evidently, maybe as many as 100 to 150 per episode. So the post-production and the pre-production has to be pretty tight.
Do we have any details on some of the background of how the shows are made?
Yes, we do. They do shoot them on film, and they then send them out to effects shops to do some of the effects, but some of them are done on set as much as they can to streamline the whole process. So they pretty much know what they're looking for, and they're flexible on the set to get it all done. But I understand the production flow is 14 days, and that's a pretty tight for that many shots. And they must have a very, very dedicated crew of people in order to pull all this off. It's the set designers, the set builders, the costumers, and all the pre-production and post-production people. They need to be working all with the same vision and same enthusiasm in order to pull this off.
Yeah, but I mean, if we look at a major show like Heroes, they're on a similar kind of timeline, so it is, I have a lot of respect for people working in episodic television because it is really hard work and terribly demanding. And people like me get really critical of the work they do and relate it to feature film, both timescales and budget. But having said that, that is the game, really, and you sort of pick your battles. I still don't know that, like, obviously this stuff is 100% set piece. Maybe outside the window here is a comp, though it could just as easily have been done with a flat because it's not moving and it's not doing anything. But it's there are sort of, some keys and stuff that, especially when that bringing the bees back to life and killing the termite sequence, were perhaps a little harsh, to say the least. There's not, like, for example, edge wrap. There's no light wrap happening on the edges against the highlight, so you get that rather distinctive sharp contrast. I mean, it's a very clean show. It's very, but I don't know that it's. I'm just worried that when you get something that's this stylized, it's said that, well, we'll be forgiving a lot of sins because it's stylized, and I don't know that I can. But John, you can, huh?
Well, like I say, I can forgive a lot of the special effects because they are stylized, and also because the set. You compare this to Heroes. I don't know if that's a fair comparison. My guess would be that this show has a much smaller budget and a hell of a lot more sets that had to be created for it. I mean, every single one of these rooms had to be built, and there's just so much detail in them. And I'm blown away by the number of sets that were created for the show. And so, and things like special effects, well, the special effects mirror the oddness of the sets. I mean, if you just let yourself go and say, okay, this is a fairy tale, it's a dream, it's, you know, maybe from the perspective of, someone telling it to children, although it is dark, you know. I think you can really get there. Like, say, the part that drives me crazy isn't the visual effects, but is the dialogue. I mean, you know, we talked before about the dialogue being this way or that way. Well, you know, there's fast-paced, clever dialogue a la Studio 60, which I believe is also canceled.
Yes.
But the dialogue is fast and clever and bizarre, but it works. Whereas the dialogue in this is fast and clever, but it obviously clever and sometimes annoying. I mean, there are aspects of it that are great, but the rest of it just annoys the hell out of me. And then we talked about something being gross. Well, one of the things I wanted to touch on was, I mentioned True Blood earlier on. True Blood there are aspects of True Blood that are so repulsive that it's hard to even look at the screen. But there's enormous amounts of humor in that show. And so they managed to pull off the taking it almost but not quite too far, but still maintaining a great sense of humor. And I think this show could have done that. And actually, I think this show suffers from being on. Is it ABC that it's on?
Mm.
I just think it suffers from being on ABC. I think it would be a little more clever and a little less goofy if it were on a different station and they were willing to take more risks.
I mean, we just saw a shot then of the street with the pie shop, and it was a wide sort of shot. There's a building in New York, I think, that has that characteristic V shot. We see it a lot in posters from New York. But it was a shot that just looked to me like it wasn't a final, in the sense that it looked great. It just didn't look like it had had the last stage of polish that sells the shot in as not being CG. It looked really up the both sides CG. And I'm getting that it's a storybook, but then I guess, you know, that's this sort of theatrical thing, isn't it? Like it's, if it's theatrical, we sort of forget. And this shot here, like, works, you know, the mermaid floating. Like, that's exactly what you'd sort of, I think, would expect. That's well executed. It looks fine. It does what it does, and it doesn't look bad. But I have seen some exterior shots, especially with skies and stuff behind characters, where they just don't look balanced in. And I don't know, maybe that's creative. They wanted to keep it that poppy. I mean, it's one of the problems, isn't it? Like, you want this show to be poppy. It is very much to me like the colors, the tone, the pacing, the dialogue. It's witty and poppy and sort of rice bubbly. Do you have rice bubbles in the States? What do you call them? Rice Krispies, I think you call them in the States. Do you know what I mean? It's trying to be very perky. Would you agree?
Well, I agree. I think it's trying to be perky and positive, and I'm ready for that sort of thing. I mean, I've seen a lot of things that have been desaturated and dark, and the whole aesthetic has been overused this whole last year, it seems to me, and I'm just ready for something fresh and bright. And as things get tougher, as times get tougher, I think people will want to have something that's a little bit more uplifting visually, and even the subject can be a little bit more uplifting. I think when things are too easy, that's when all the dark stuff gets really popular.
Okay, but would you say, for example, Mad Men was dark?
I enjoyed Mad Men a lot, and I think the main character is definitely tortured, and he has an unknown background that we don't fully understand yet. I only got to watch the first season so far, since I was catching up on DVDs, watching it, and I'm waiting for the second season to come out on DVD before watching it. But I was very impressed with it, and it was an interesting sociological study as far as where women were in the work world back then in the 60s. And whether it's accurate or not, I can't say, but certain aspects of it that do make you think about it.
So I guess this comes down to a question of whether or not we are willing to suspend disbelief in a way that makes the world, you know, very non-literal. I mean, I think Mad Men is stylized, and I think it's magnificent. I think it's really just terrific. And there are a lot of other shows, of course, that need to be in some way different because they're either period or whatever. This show is getting there with the visual effects, but it's got that sort of problem that, you know, what do you judge it by? Because you can't judge it then maybe by realism, because theoretically it's not trained, it's meant to be sort of theatrical and stylized. So the only thing I'm left with, if that's our case, is does it take me out of the show? So I can say honestly that I was absorbed in something like Moulin Rouge, which was I know it's a major film, but it was still very theatrical, but I was still in that world and not taken out of it. I've several times been taken out of the show by the visual effects in this. So for whatever reason, that's my criteria. I don't have a better one to go on. John, do you? What do we judge this by?
You know, it's really funny. Upon second viewing of this show, I realize that what I'm looking at is, in fact, a kind of version of what the Stepford Wives looked like. And I'm not sure how that's settling with me. Do you remember the Stepford Wives and then the remake with Nicole Kidman?
The Nicole Kidman version, yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't it look like that to you?
Yeah.
I remember when I left the movie, The Stepford Wives, I thought to myself, oh, my God, you know, what are you guys doing with the color of this film? You've just destroyed it. But I think, you know, in the case of the Stepford Wives, they destroyed it because it didn't even come close to matching what they were trying to accomplish with the story and, you know, and just with the visual imagery. I mean, I think we can all agree that was a mediocre at best movie. Go ahead.
I was going to say, we can applaud the filmmakers for trying something different. I mean, I certainly can. I totally respect anyone that tries to do something that's not just, you know, basically a, you know, police cop drama murder using bits of sci-fi, and I say sci-fi, but they, you know, medical imaging to solve the murder. Because, you know, there's a lot of that. So somebody's, I think, pushing the envelope. I just feel like the only thing I can think of was Moulin Rouge. I have a good example of something that goes super stylized, unless it's a kid's thing, that I thought worked in terms of these sort of very graphic, very poppy visual effects. I mean, it's, you know, these sort of strong pinks, strong yellows, strong saturated color thing, like the watering can in the bright green behind her in the shot and stuff. Like, that's all a look. I just can't think of many examples where that's worked really well. You know, unless it's like the kitchen of Roger Rabbit or, you know, it's in Enchanted, which is a kid's film. In an adult drama, I mean, can anyone got an example of this stuff looking great and a theatrical stylized? I guess if you go dark, I can give you tons of them. I can give you tons of, you know, stuff that has been done that's dark and stylized, and I've been quite happy with it, you know. But
I've seen, I don't know if you've seen it over in Australia, but Ugly Betty is another ABC show that has got a very bright color palette and a very designed style to it. It's been going over pretty well. It's about a life at a fashion magazine in New York City. Are you familiar with that one?
I am, yeah. And I don't actually watch it, but I know of the show. But this comp we're looking at now with the Sound of Music thing, like, it was good on the hill, right? But when they went to the side shot, didn't it suffer for you guys? The nuns walking past shot?
Oh, yeah. The motion blur was off, yeah.
It didn't take me out of the story, though. I think I must be involved enough with the characters and what's going on with them that as long as it doesn't jar me out of there, and it didn't jar me at the time, I'm fine with it.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that's jarring me out as much as the visual effects is the propensity for using a wide-angle lens whenever possible. But leaving that aside for a second, I guess we just differ on this point, because when I see the Sound of Music shot, I like buy the first one. We go to the second one, it's like they ran out of money. And then we just have this question of like, is that theatrical and valid, or is that and stylized, or am I just being a stick in the mud? And the only thing, as I say, if it didn't take you out, that's terrific. For me, I was just immediately trying to work out how I'd redo that shot to make it better, and what was wrong with the mountains, and, you know, just the lack of molding lighting and just a ton of stuff. But I guess we just disagree on this point, because it's really, as I said, you know, I can't think of a better way of trying to find a barometer for judging by than... And if you stay in the plot, I guess, if you've seen the first series, I didn't have the benefit of doing that. Maybe that's one of the reasons you're really engrossed in these characters, though I think that Sound of Music scene was probably just played for laughs. Do we know who did the visual effects on this?
Yes, we do. The visual effects supervisor is William Pulaski, and the visual effects producer is Elizabeth Castro. They would be doing most of the visual effects done in post-production. The main production designer is Michael Wiley, and he'd be in charge of all the on-set special effects. Obviously, they all share a common common vision that Barry Sonnenfeld put together with Brian Fuller. Brian Fuller's the creator, and Barry Sonnenfeld did the directing of the first two episodes and kind of set the tone for a lot of this visual style. Brian Fuller had done another show called Wonderfalls. I don't know if you've heard of that, but it was a short-lived series that I saw on DVD. Very similar in its uniqueness and story to this show. And unfortunately, it was on Fox and was only shown for four episodes before it was canceled. So the DVD viewers are the ones that actually see what that series was all about.
Yeah, I mean... I understand, you know, where they're coming from. I just don't know that I can sustain it. And I wonder, does it, I guess this is the central question, is if you saw more than one of these episodes, if you kept on watching it, whether you'd become more enveloped in the world and love it to death and care about the characters, or whether it would just start to tire as a kind of one-trick pony of kind of very stylized play. Now,
well,
John,
I think you're getting your answer, right? I mean, the reality is that we are in season two and it is being canceled. And so I think, you know, it's either a situation where it's like Firefly, where, you know, the studios are morons and canceled it because they can't find a good show with both hands, or it's that people have tired of it. And I think my guess is that this... Having seen two episodes, I watched the first episode of season one, and then I watched, obviously, this episode, which is the first episode of season two. I felt like this would get really, really old after a while. So I'm guessing maybe other people felt that way too. Or,
I mean, I'm not so familiar with the show. Certainly, I, you know, don't buy it. But then I just like when I can get more involved with the characters, and I believe that there's more dimension to the characters and there's more going on with them and more coming. And this stuff, like we're seeing now, is kind of slapsticky comedy. And if we had this amount of slapstick in an episode of Friends, I'd think it was too much slapstick. It's too much for an episode of Get Smart. So I'm, you know, I'm like, and I've watched those shows since I was a kid. So,
exactly. One of the big issues here too, when you talk about over the top and slapsticky and maybe something getting a little tiresome, Ned, who is this character right here on the left, Lee Pace, who really hasn't been in anything else except apparently Wonderfalls. And then the other character, I believe Anna Friel plays Chuck, you know, Charles. Because, when we find this out in the very beginning, because she dies and he brings her back to life, you know, you saw that all that weird foreplay in the beginning, he can't touch her again.
Yep.
This is not like an X-Files romance, they can't kiss kind of thing, which is actually sustainable. This is a, they really can't kiss, because if he does touch her, she's done, right? She's dead, for real dead. And I just wonder how much, I mean, that is a strange thing to play out. And I think you almost have to find other more equally bizarre and kind of inflated things to do, because you can't really approach the core issue of this show, which is these two people are in love and incapable of touching one another, because that would get tiresome as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm at like the Flying Nun for any reference of of kind of, it's this caricature thing. Now, having said that, like, we're meant to be discussing the visual effects and not the acting, but I think this is probably just something that plays well. Like, I think if I was the sort of person that really liked, what was the reference to the other show that you mentioned?
Wonderfalls?
No. Sorry, the other one with the girl in the fashion industry.
Ugly Betty.
Ugly Betty. Yeah. So I know there are people that just think Ugly Betty is the greatest thing since sliced bread. And again, it's not a show that I've ever really watched, and I'm probably not their target demographic. But I think probably if you were what's the demographic for this? Is this like we aimed at, you know, sort of late teens, young people, or is this meant to be like a more serious? Is John Flowers our target audience, or is my daughter's in a couple of years the target audience?
It feels a little bit to me like John Flowers is the target audience, but they missed, you know, because it can't really be a bunch of young people. I mean, the subject matter is
too bleak.
It's bleak. I mean, it's hopeful because of the bright colors and the, you know, there's love wins out and those sort of things, but it's bleak in the sense that you saw when all those bees came back to life. You know, the counter to that was, you know, just a gutter full of cockroaches or mites or whatever died, you know. So I think they kind of missed that. I was thinking about another show you asked earlier. What's another show that had just crazy bright saturated colors that's been successful? And we're not the target demographic, but I think Desperate Housewives is probably an example that I would put forth and say.
Okay, I can see a line from Desperate Housewives to this, definitely. And Laurie, do you like Desperate Housewives?
I don't watch Desperate Housewives, but I know some people who do. But I've watched it once. It was at my brother's house, and he was watching it with his family. But I was never interested in watching another episode. It just didn't appeal to me.
Do you see the similarities in art direction that that John's alluding to?
It's been quite a while since I've seen that show, but I do remember maybe some oversaturated colors, maybe some interesting camera moves that might have been similar. But like I said, I don't have a clear memory of that show.
I mean, it was a bit white picket fencing, idealized street kind of thing, I think, especially when it started. And certainly its promos and its art direction of its title sequence and stuff all stacked in that general direction. I think that we have a problem with visual effects that is central, which is that we find it pretty easy to gauge stuff when it's given a realism. I mean, if you were trying to do Mad Men and make it look like he was visiting a real Los Angeles in the period that you're talking about, then, you know, you can go to the history books and work out what the Pan Am logo was like at that point in time and build out from there. If we are trying to do if we're trying to do something that we, that's a nice matte painting. If we are trying to do something that is not quite as obvious in terms of, you know, a reference because it's so heavily stylized, then we have to try and come up with the rules of engagement. And the rules of engagement need to fit both with the art direction of the program, but also with what the audience is going to walk the line on. My problem is just I can't think of a good example of getting this sort of super theatrical stuff that works for me. But I think you're right, John. I think Housewives is probably one of the closest examples. But this is a pretty well done shot. What do we think about this sequence here with the bees? I mean, this is believable if we cancel the color palette for a second. Don't we think?
I would completely agree with that. It is absolutely believable if you buy the color palette, because the bees fit well within the color palette that the show has decided is the actual color palette. Now, in any reasonable way, these bees don't make any damn sense. They're too, you know, they're too yellow and bee-like, but
they do just certainly the thing you need them to do. They're creepy, and they give the effect that you want when you see all that stuff flying towards you. That's very disturbing. Right.
But for me, the fact that we've come back to a shot when she just was previously covered in bees and we're just now having a narration around a table talking like normal, I'm like so like jumped the friggin' couch and jumped the shark and jumped anything else that happened to be lying around. Because if you know, I had a swarm of bees just on my arm, let alone over my whole body, I'd be flipping out. And so it's just like, so can you criticize the visual effects? Well, no, they were just spot on the mark. They were really well executed, very graphic, not too scary for little kids, but definitely great for the trailer. Does it work as a show for me, that scene? Well, no, because I had no payoff from the characters. No, they were immediately back to normality. The fact that she was encased in bees and had to spit this thing out and stuff is forgotten 2 seconds later, and we just moved on, and it's all like it never happened. And so I guess that's why maybe I'm a little harsh on the visual effects. I mean, maybe there are some shots that aren't carrying it so much, but I'm probably more grated by this this very, very strict world of feeling like this is the visual equivalent of a Spice Girls pop song. I'd love to know how many of these individual shots are virtual sets, though, because maybe I'm missing a lot of work that they've done.
I think you are. I think, like, if you look at this, I think a lot of the background here, you can actually see the key.
Yeah, that's a virtual
spill,
set.
Bleed, yeah. So this is a virtual set, except for maybe a few of the benches.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the things I was going to say is when I first watched this show, I was completely blown away by the number of scenes in which there is some compositing, some keying, some virtual set, something going on. I mean, I would wager that more than 50% of this episode has some kind of visual effect just crammed into it that you may or may not see. And some of the weirdness that you're seeing is, you know, it's weird because they slap together a 14-day schedule, you know, a 40-some-odd-minute show with a lot of set design and compositing and things that are not easy to do in 14 days on a limited budget.
No, absolutely. I mean, and, you know, you want a show, especially the first one out of the first show in the season, to be, you know, it's quite acceptable that the writers would write that as an effects-heavy ep. Because, you know, you want to get good ratings at the beginning of the season, so you're not going to be pulling punches and holding back on your first show of your first, return series, this being series two. So even in your normal 14-day budget, maybe this was a bit top-heavy. The problem, I think, is partly, though, that, the ambitiousness of writers and stuff then falls on visual effects, and visual effects do need a disproportionate amount of time for that last 5% of polish. I mean, there are some shots in here that somebody could have spent an extra couple of days on, and I'd have loved them to death, especially those wide shots of the pie shop. And yet, you know, obviously a couple of extra days is completely unreasonable if you've only got a 14-day turnaround on an episodic show. I mean, this house I thought was quite reasonable. It looked a bit CG, but I could buy it. I thought it was a good, you know, given the graphic nature of the set, I thought whoever did this particular shot spinning around the back of the house did a really good job. But I guess I was helped by the fact that it wasn't super saturated in color. What do you think of the house?
John? I'm sorry, I'm not sure who you were asking, but I'll say, here's another case, Mike, exactly what you're talking about. This is, and it's funny, when we were getting here, I was going to say the end of this is probably visually the most work and the most impressive out of the whole show. And yet, you're right. It is the one part of the show that is absolutely not saturated with color. And so maybe it works because it doesn't look so funky. I don't know.
Laurie, what do you think of the this from the front of the house to the back of the house reveal?
I liked it. I think it does give a relief to go back and forth between darker scenes where they're aren't as many colors going on, and this is a good point for doing that. I think it adds to the drama here that it's nighttime and they're dealing with these questions here of the mystery, who's behind all this stuff with the bees.
Yeah, I mean, the specialist nature of a, you know, house like that shot, I mean, this is not like a regular set that they're visiting each week. So this is a good thing to judge a program by, because obviously you could argue that the, and I would, that you're going to come back to the pie shop many times during the series. So it's the Enterprise argument, right? When they first produced Star Trek The Next Generation, the writers wrote in a scene down in engineering because they knew later in the series they'd need an engineering room, and they knew they'd only get it if it was written into the first script and they already had that set built. Because, you know, you're amortizing the cost over the whole series. And in a shot like that house, I think it's fair to judge the show on, because no one is expecting to come back to that shot or to come back to that set. It's not a pivotal point for the show. It's not even a pivotal point for the episode, I don't think. So when those shots work, then I feel, you know, like the bees encasing the woman earlier, you know, they're good things to judge by because they're on the episodic timetable of what's going on. I think surprisingly worked better than what I would have considered to be the standard set pieces like the pie shop. Do you know what I'm saying about that set piecing?
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that's a pretty interesting commentary, the Star Trek. I mean, I've heard that as well. I've heard that Joss Whedon did that on Firefly. He knew that he needed all these aspects of the ship, so he literally wrote them into the first episode so that he would, you know, have them for later. You know, Mike, you were talking a little bit about sort of the absurdity of this. By the way, there's a terrible key there. one thing that's, and this is where I was saying it falls apart for me. The entire way in which they catch this guy is they have evidence of the queen bee that he has spit out of his mouth, that evidence right there.
Yep.
And it's spit into the mouth of the other person. And yet this entire arrest hinges on the fact that they have evidence of his saliva on that little cube.
After she'd swallowed it and she'd spat it outside.
Exactly. So it just really, that's what I'm talking about when I say, wow, you know, how do you handle it? And I also realized what doesn't work for me. You were talking about how this targets certain kinds of people. This feels like, and it just occurred to me, it feels like Edward Scissorhands. I think that is the best example of a completely false, totally surreal, absolutely saturated, fake world that we're meant to buy into.
Oh, no, hang on. Edward Scissorhands has its dark, I mean, terrifically dark.
No, I'm not. What I'm saying is if you were to compare this show to anything before it, it feels like they're going for Edward Scissorhands, which is...
Yeah, but
dark.
Comparing these guys to Tim Burton is just cruel. I mean, Tim Burton's like one of my favorite directors. He's like the emperor of stylized, gorgeous, dark, and interesting.
You wouldn't argue, though, that taking out your own personal emotional state, that this looks and feels a lot like an Edward Scissorhands-y kind of show?
I think you're being generous. I think if I'd suggest that to you. Yeah, go on.
Bottom left-hand corner, there's a hair on the lens. I noticed.
Yeah, no,
that
isn't
first,
that great?
It drove me crazy. I was like, wow, we can comp shit together, but we can't
remove
the
lens in the bottom left, yeah.
Yeah, we can't wire remove a hair. Anyway.
That's of the, which is in the, and the pig comes into the room. If you look in the bottom left of frame. Yep. Yeah, okay, look, I think you've been kind. I think I don't hate this shot with the intensity of 1,000 white hot suns, but giving it Burton-esque comparisons is just, you know, I don't know. I love Tim Burton stuff. I mean, and he certainly does pull it off big time. But, you know, it's a masterful director that does, and I don't even know that Tim Burton pulled it off necessarily in certain parts of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Would you agree with that, or... Did you like that?
Yeah, I couldn't stand it. But most kids like it, although that makes me feel a little weird because I thought Johnny Depp was disturbing in that role.
Yeah, he was too Michael Jackson for my taste. So Laurie, I've expressed my lack of love of the show. But have I persuaded you at all, or are you as entrenched in your position of appreciation as you were when you started?
I still like the show quite a bit, and I'm hoping that the last three episodes of this season will eventually get on the air. There have been 10 out of the 13 that are available on iTunes right now, and I don't see any date for the next episode to be shown yet. I know that there was some question about how they were going to tie up the series, and they may be re-editing or doing something in order to make it a series finale instead of just a cliffhanger end of season finale, as if they were going to do another season. So I would hate to see them just leave it where it was after the episode 10 of this season. I would like to see what they would do with it next. And I have enjoyed the show quite a bit. And I don't care what you say.
Good on for you. I do think the 3D team was doing a pretty good job in various points. I think some of the compositing wasn't up to scratch, but I mean, that was a scheduling thing. And hopefully there was a lot more visual effects than I could see, and that, in fact, it was a lot better than I thought. John, do you want to sum up your position?
I still think that it could be better if it were on a network that would take more chances. And, it saddens me because it's a kind of show that I personally desperately, deeply want to love, but I just don't.
I think I'm right in saying that one of my business partners, Jeff, thought it was magnificent and brilliant. And I also came to it thinking that I would want to like it because, you know, Laurie recommended it and she's an intelligent woman. So I thought that sounds like a good thing. And I the first time I tried watching it, I couldn't even get through the app. That's how much I was like, it wears me out. Now, maybe it's a cultural thing. Maybe this is a lack of Australian sensitivity to the subtlety of American culture in its art-directed form when expressed in Pushing Up the Daisies. But I do thank you for recommending it for us to view, Laurie. Thank you so much.
Well, I hope that some people will take a look at it. I know that there's a petition going around. Over 80,000 signatures are on it right now to try to influence the studio to continue with the show. And, it may not be too late to at least get those last three episodes up on the air.
Well, I'll put my signature to the Firefly one, if that's all right with you. But as you say, thank you so much for joining us. And if people wanted to follow you or check you out or see some of your work, where can they go?
I have a new website now. I'm going to be doing a new podcast similar to For Art's Sake. It's called artistsonart.tv. And within the next week or two, there should be the first episode up.
And what sort of art are you looking at?
It's contemporary artists, but in a traditional, representational, subject matter. So the first artist is Jeremy Lipking, who's a very talented painter. And the second artist will be Sarah Perry, who is a sculptor.
Oh, beautiful. I must admit, I'm a huge fan of sort of postmodern art and contemporary art, especially out of Britain. It's an absolute passion of mine. So I look forward to watching your show. And John, what about you?
I think if you head on over to lifezero.org, you can find a link to all of the madness that I spew onto the internets.
And do you want to thank our producers and team this week, John?
Sure. I'd love to thank Kristen Martin, who's been doing a great job putting the shows together and editing them and, putting up with the kind of weird ins and outs that we have of course being geographically distributed across multiple states and continents and countries and coming from satellite, all of these kind of problems that we have. Laurie, who's on the show with us, did a fantastic job as always of putting together the information that we needed to be smart when we talked about this, so she's been doing a great job there as well.
Nice to have you on after all your help. Thank you so much for all of that.
Thanks for having me on.
So I'm Mike Seymour. I'm over at fxguide.com primarily and also fxphd.com where we do training and consulting work. Until next time, I hope you guys enjoy this. Please let us know what you think in the forums and also over at Twitter. I'm on Twitter as /Mike Seymour. Until next time, which I think we'll be returning to the world of feature film, we'll see you later. Thanks, guys. Bye.